Enrique is exactly right when you see Jesus saying something like, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." He's giving you a tip. Slow down. Ponder. Hearken until you have an epiphany. Pay attention. Which is necessary because him comparing us to salt, at least to me, is not immediately obvious what he's talking about. Why are we salt in Jesus' mind? It's taken a fair bit of pondering on my part this week. I consulted with various congregational experts trying to figure out what could possibly make salt useful for soil, as Jesus implies, and between our resident chemist and our authority on gardening and our plant scientist, I am here to tell you, we don't know. That is going to take more pondering, or the acquisition of ears to hear, because apparently we don't got them right now. We can draw out from this a vision that Jesus has for his people that goes in sharp contrast both against the expectations of the crowds that are around Jesus right now. The context verse for this is all the way back in 25. Now, great crowds accompanied Jesus, and he turned and said to them, and then he's been talking since verse 25. So he's still speaking to a huge crowd of people that are excited about what he's been doing and have gathered to him. And he's trying to make clear to them, my idea of the good life is very different from yours. And his picture here of us as salt is also, I think, in sharp contrast to the idea of the good life that we've grown up around, that we've absorbed. And I hope to show you that over the course of the sermon. First with the opening phrase, salt is good. Good how and good why? Well, we don't understand the soil thing, right? It is apparently it's good for the manure pile. Manure was a primary fuel. The land of Israel is not covered in endless renewable fir trees. That not everyone has a huge stack of three cords of firewood ready to burn, but they did have a lot of animal manure. And they would use that for heating and for baking. And in order to preserve that, they would put salt on the manure pile. So that's one use. And then the other one that Jesus refers to is taste, seasoning food, maybe a little bit more familiar. I can already see people's faces like, Jesus, can we get a different metaphor? No? Well, didn't you say something about the light of the world? That sounded nice. These things are good. And they're the specific type of good that comes from the word Jesus uses here. He uses the word kalos, which is often translated good or beautiful, but it particularly means ordinary goodness, simple beauty, right? The kind of goodness that is easy to overlook. And it's in direct contrast, deliberate contrast on Jesus' part with another Greek word that he could have used that also can be translated good. That word is arete. The word arete can mean good, but it carries the connotation of excellence, of optimization, of being all you can possibly be. Right? So an F1 car, right? F1 racing that they do internationally now, and it's like these guys drive like 200 miles an hour. An F1 car is arete good. Every aspect of it, like the weight, the engine, the shape of the undercarriage of the car for the sake of airflow is optimized for speed. All right? My 2006 Toyota Yaris hatchback that I inherited from my grandfather is kalos good. It is reliable. It is simple. It is Joan's favorite car on planet Earth. It gets you from A to B. It does what you need to do. And never, ever has anyone said to me, man, that's a cool car. Right? Earlier this morning, Sebastian Sawe became the first person to run a marathon in under 2 hours. Right? That's some arete good running. Earlier this year, I barely kept up with my daughter Lucy on a 3 mile run. That's some kalos good running. And Jesus is calling us to the kalos life. He says, you are salt, and salt is kalos. Salt is ordinary goodness. Salt is simple beauty. Salt is not excellence. Salt is not greatness. That word arete was used in the Greek and the Roman world as a sort of general word for virtue, because you were trying to optimize yourself, to outdo everyone else and have people looking up to you with awe. It was just how everybody expected life to be. You're pursuing arete. Right? I'm trying to do better than everybody else. And everybody else is trying to do better than me. It's this life organized around competitive greatness. And that's still the spirit of our world. I grew up in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, a university town, very much like this one, but on the other side of the country. And I went to the local public high school, and we had a motto. The motto of the school was excellence for all students. Setting aside, that's not possible, right? Like, and an educational institution should really be able to figure out that if everyone excels, no one is excelling. Just like, put that aside, right? That is a motto for an institution that is bought into the arete life. Compete to stand out. Seek to exceed one another. Pursue greatness. And the high school wasn't bashful about wanting us to do this and then seeing itself as in an arete competition with other high schools. We want to be able to see, like, did we have more students take advanced classes? How did our average SAT scores compare? How many students got into Ivy League schools? Right. Optimize, maximize, exceed, succeed, be great. This is the world we live in. And it is exhausting. It is exhausting for people who do pretty well at the arete game. Folks who win more competitions than they lose. Because there's no such thing as enough competitions that you've won. There's always something else. Right now, somebody has to run a marathon in less than an hour and 59 minutes. And the arete world is exhausting for the people who lose more than they win. Because it's continually telling us, you're not one of the people who counts. You're not among the ones who matter. Jesus comes into a moment in time when even the people of God have bought into this arete life and says, I have something different for you. I am calling you to the kalos life of ordinary goodness. Not betterness, goodness. The life of simple beauty. Not magazine cover beauty, simple beauty. I have something different for you. And so he chooses a picture like salt. Salt is not glamorous. It's not extraordinary. Everybody's got it in their house. And everybody's glad that they have it in their house. Because salt is good for ordinary life, for making simple food a little more beautiful to taste. Friend, the life Jesus is calling you to, is not a great and extraordinary one. It is not a life of anxiously competing to excel, to stand out, to win. Jesus is calling you to a life of ordinary goodness, of simple beauty, a life of salt, a kalos life. He calls us to this life, saying, and it's a good life. It's the life you're made for. And then he immediately starts talking about what happens if it goes wrong. Salt is good, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? So salt is good, but salt needs to be salt. That's the second thing Jesus is drawing our attention to. Salt is good, but salt needs to be salt. Salt that isn't salt is not good. Salt needs to be salt. So if salt has lost its taste, Enrique referenced this, this should make everyone who dealt with salt on a regular basis or folks who understand chemistry go, that can't happen. Salt doesn't lose its taste. It is a very stable compound. Salt is just salt. Sodium and chloride, they love hanging out. When they covenant together, they don't get divorced. Right? Salt is salty. Right? So what's going on here? Right? Jesus is referring to salt that was taken from the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is a body of water in Israel that is approximately 10 times as salty as the Pacific Ocean. And so instead of 3% salt, the Dead Sea is 30% or more salt. So it's a great place to get salt. And that's where everyone in the crowd that's listening to Jesus would have gone to get their salt, or somebody, you know, a merchant would have brought it to them. But the salt was mixed together with all kinds of other minerals, at least some of the time. So you'd gather up a bunch of water from the Dead Sea, you boil the water goes away, now you're left with hopefully mostly salt, but maybe salt and a bunch of other stuff. So the picture here isn't of sodium chloride, the formula for salt, suddenly not being that anymore. The picture is of true salt mixed together with a bunch of other stuff that isn't salt, so that when you try to taste it, it doesn't taste salty. Or when you try to do whatever you're supposed to do to the soil with it, it doesn't work. Or it doesn't preserve the manure for you. It fails because it's been diluted by other things. The concern here is not that salt itself would stop being salty, but that salt would be so swirled up and surrounded and mixed in with other stuff that it loses its power. What's Jesus really talking about? He's talking about his followers. He's talking about Christians. If you're a Christian, if you trust in Jesus, then you are salt. There is in you the true grace of God poured out through Jesus Christ. But like the salt in the Dead Sea, there's also a bunch of other stuff. When the moment when you are saved by God, the salt gets added. Right? That grace, That newfound life in the Spirit is there. But it doesn't automatically expel everything else that's in you. And so the picture here is of someone who's seeking to and claiming to follow Jesus while keeping everything else. What am I really talking about here? If you look inside your mind and heart as a human being, this is true whether you're a Christian or not, you're going to find a swarm of competing interests and priorities. Lots of different things that you want in different ways and at different times that are often directly opposed to one another. The theology over the years has called these your loves, the many different things that you love, right? So I love the idea of being in really good shape, and I really love Tillamook mudslide ice cream, right? These things exist in me, right? The existence of one does not erase the existence of the other, but they are fighting for pride of place in my loves. Yes? And that's just, you know, that's the low-hanging fruit of examples. We've got gazillions of them, all fighting over each other. Picture that weedy garden bed, right? All these different species competing for the same soil, the same nutrients, the same attention in our hearts. That's us. Jesus adds the best possible plant, right in the center. The thing that will abide and bear fruit. But he does not automatically and instantly take out everything else that is competing. And if we leave the weeds, we lose the saltiness. The real thing won't grow and thrive. Jesus is not seeking to be the only priority any more than he wants you to go on a diet of only salt. He is intending to be the highest priority and the one that orders all of the other priorities. That is the place that he's claiming. And he is inviting us to be restored through letting him reorder our priorities. He asks that question in verse 34, if salt loses its taste, how can it be restored? And the intuitive everyday answer is, it's possible to purify and sift salt, but it's not worth it. It's way too much effort for way too little gain. And so people, if they got a bad batch of salt, they would just throw it out and try to find a better one. So they hear Jesus ask this question, how shall its saltiness be restored? And they think, well, I mean, maybe it could happen, but I'm not going to do that. That's way too much work. Right? Which for me, at least, totally maps onto the, like, how will my heart be restored and my priorities put in order? I'm like, well, that I can see how that could happen, but that's a lot of work. I'd rather not engage in it. With God, all things are possible. And the broader context here, this is really all of chapter 14, is Jesus saying, let me restore you. Let me sift through and reorder your priorities. Some will get more space in the garden bed of your heart. Some will get less. Some will need to be pulled out and thrown away entirely. But trust me to lead you over time in sorting through the priorities. Trust me to restore your saltiness. This is a lifelong process. This is actually, that's a decent summary of the entire Christian life, is having Jesus and the Holy Spirit who works with him sift through and restore your priorities. And it's also quite personal, right? I needed Jesus in the early 2010s to reduce my priority of playing competitive Ultimate Frisbee, most people in the room are not going to need that. But we do get some clear signals from Jesus about what kinds of shifts will be involved right in the preceding verses. Jesus tells us, for instance, that as he's in the process of restoring our saltiness, we will put a lower priority on wealth and prosperity. This is verse 33. Right before our text. So therefore, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. Jesus is saying that having me as your highest priority, your greatest love, is not compatible with a growing priority on money, wealth, and prosperity. Not that all money and wealth is evil, but that for most human beings, it's taking up too much space in the garden bed. And Jesus, in restoring our saltiness, is going to shrink the amount of nutrients that wealth is allowed to receive. That's one way he'll be reordering our priorities. Another that he's taking off the table is the like huge visible project. So he just gave these two examples that are kind of weird for Jesus about building towers and raising armies to fight battles. His point being, I'm not going to be doing that sort of thing, which is what the crowd wants him to do, right? They're there because they think Jesus is the one who's going to like become the new King David and lead us to fight off the great Roman armies and establish the land again as a fortress that we can live in peace. And Jesus is trying to say as emphatically as he can, no, I have not come to win the kind of fights you think are important, to build the kind of things that you think matter. Our grand plans are going to shrink as priorities as Jesus restores our saltiness. On the other hand, suffering love is going to grow as a priority, as Jesus teaches us to take up the cross. As Jesus restores our saltiness and reorders our priorities, we're going to spend less time on our grand plans so that we can spend more time sharing in the suffering of those around us. This is not sounding good, right? But turn it around. When you have been suffering, what have you needed? Someone to come to you with a grand plan to end your suffering? No. You've needed someone to weep with those who weep, to embrace sharing in your sorrow for love's sake. Two, be salt and join you. This is the restoring of our saltiness, the ongoing, lifelong reordering our own priorities and interests to align with those of Jesus. If we are going to be salt, we need to be salt. Salt is good. Salt needs to be salt. Or else. Verse 34 paints us a good and hopeful picture of the Christian life. Verse 35 is Jesus warning us what happens if we choose not to participate. This is specifically a warning to professing Christians, to folks who would say, yeah, I'm with Jesus, but he needs to leave my priorities alone and let me do my thing. I've got this figured out. If salt does not have its saltiness restored, Jesus says, it is of no use. either for the soil or for the manure pile, it is thrown away. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Christian, you can be in the process of having your saltiness restored by Jesus, or you can be thrown away. That's the whole list of options. You can be in the process of Jesus reordering your priorities, readjusting your loves, or you can be in the process of waiting for garbage day. There's not a middle road there. When Jesus says, if salt loses its saltiness, he uses a much more general word there for loses its saltiness. It means usually become foolish or even go mad. So it's kind of like if salt loses its mind, how can its saltiness be restored? He's speaking to the fundamental of insanity of hearing Jesus call you to the kalos life and then saying, yeah, but first I need to be excellent and great and exceed and do better than my neighbors and my family members and my siblings. Then maybe I'll get around to the kalos life. He's speaking to the fundamental insanity of this crowd of would-be Christians, saying like, we hear your call to love Jesus, but like there's a political fight with Rome in front of us, and we really have to win the next election cycle before we get around to what you have for us. He's speaking to the fundamental insanity of hearing Jesus say, unless you renounce what you have, you cannot be my disciple, and saying, I get it, but I have to build a career. And I'll try and fit you in around the edges. There is no such thing as a Christian who has Jesus somewhere, you know, between 20th and 30th on their priority list. He came to claim the top spot, not to nibble around the edges of your heart, but to sit down on the throne and refuse to give it up. And if you will let him do that, every move he makes to change your priorities, to reorder your loves, to restore your saltiness, will be for your good. But if you say, Jesus, I'm so glad you're here. Hang out in the waiting room. I've got other appointments to keep first. He does not promise to wait there for you. He warns you, I am here for the throne. Salt needs to be salt. You face, probably every day, certainly every week of your life, the choice between the kalos life that Jesus is calling you to, a life of ordinary goodness and simple beauty, where he gets to set the agenda, where he gets to order your loves. You face a choice between that and the arete life that the world around you and probably your own heart is crying out for, where you are constantly measuring your place in the pecking order, either striving anxiously to move up a few spots or sitting in shame because you know you're never going to get to the top. That's the choice. Hear the call of Jesus and answer. Let him have the throne. Let him set the agenda. Let him order your loves. Submit to this lifelong process. Right? And there's good news in that lifelong process too, right? If I, in the competition between fitness and Tillamook, right? If I go home and polish off the carton of Tillamook mudslide that is in my freezer, and really somebody should eat it before all the teenagers get home to save them from it. Right? Right. If I do that today, I am not doomed to bad fitness forever and ever. Right? If you look back on the last week and go, yeah, Jesus didn't even make the top 30, that isn't the end of the story. But if you look back on the last week and go, yeah, Jesus didn't even make the top 30, and I'll get around to it. You don't have forever to keep saying, I'll get around to it. It is time to let him sit where he belongs, in the center, on the throne, at the height of your loves. And you can trust him to take that place, because he's already shown you what his agenda is. He has already shown you that his love is for you. He can't make you any higher of a priority than willingly bearing his own cross, willingly dying in your place that you might have life. Isn't that the sort of person you want calling the shots? Isn't Jesus exactly who you would want sitting on the throne? Yeah. Uh-huh. I don't know. Excellent. Yeah. Yeah.
So he seems to be making himself not out to be the extraordinary, but to be the standard good. And that's just like, I struggle with that. How does that work in the paradigm?
What, like Jesus is kalos.
Yeah.
He's not arete,
mm-hmm.
Right?
He calls himself kalos.
Yeah, yeah. So arete is something you kind of climb up to, mm-hmm. Right? You set this goal to be extraordinary, right? To, I don't know, be the best guitarist in the Willamette Valley, right? And you achieve. All of Jesus' goodness travels the other direction, yes? Right? He comes down to be our good shepherd. And he doesn't compete in any of the metrics of excellence that the world would give to him, right? Like, Jesus, you know, he's a rabbi, a traveling teacher, and the rabbis of the day had an arete competition over like Bible knowledge and sounding clever. Right? So Jesus could have hung out in the temple every day, owning the rabbis, as we might say online, right? And just constantly winning. Instead, he chooses to go out with the sheep, be with the people who can't help him in the arete competition, who won't ever make him seem great in the eyes of the world. Right? That man, ask me more about kalos, and the Hebrew word is tov, like all the way back to Genesis 1, and God said, that's good, right? God didn't say, like, that's the best cherry tree ever. He created trees, and he said, that's good. Right? God is not the one who puts pressure on you to be the best mom ever, to be the best student ever. He's the one who says, like, I made you a mom, and that's good. I put you in school, and that's good. You feel how much less anxious that life is. How much sweeter to just leave the competition behind and walk with your good shepherd. Any other questions? Yeah, Linda. Arete is, okay, Hercules is arete. Arete is too small a word for Jesus, right? Because it's a comparison word, right? Like, between me and Jim, who's sitting next to you, Jim is the arete organ player because he's better than I am, right? But Jesus, you can't speak of Jesus in comparison. He is infinitely transcendent, right? So to compare him to any of us in any aspect is insulting to him. And yet he chooses to become one of us, to dwell in our midst, to embrace us in love. He makes arete irrelevant. He doesn't say like, there's a competition I want to win. He lives this whole life who says, what are you competing over? Come and be with me. Sure. There's nerd alert. One of the main words for preaching in the New Testament is dialogue. So they would go to the synagogue on the Sabbath day and dialogue. I know. So thank you and thank you. Let's pray. Oh. Father, you are good. And goodness flows down from you and surrounds us. Open our eyes to see your good gifts. Teach us to treat the arete competition for what it is, irrelevant. Pull those weeds of striving excellence from our hearts. Restore our saltiness. Teach us to live lives of receiving and giving your good love. Amen. We come now to the good table of Jesus, where the very elements, the bread and the cup, are simple and beautiful, ordinary and nourishing. We come to receive from Jesus the goodness we need and want to participate in and cannot produce on our own.